necessity on the one hand of our feeling humble, but when you start realizing how insignificant from a spiritual perspective, not a self-deprecating or low self-esteem kind of perspective, but a spiritual perspective, we're insignificant. In the big picture of things, we're insignificant. Absolutely insignificant. So tiny, just a little speck in the totality of everything. So with that insignificance, and on top of it, whatever impurities are piled on top of our insignificance, what is it that we can do? What is it that we can offer? What is it that we can perform that's offerable to the Supreme Lord? And the answer is nothing. But that's a nice feeling, because the Lord is very merciful. We discussed this yesterday. The Lord is very merciful. And because of His merciful nature, we can expect His mercy, because it's His merciful nature. There's one reference here where from the Nisringa Purana, where Lord Nisringadeva says, where is that? Something to the effect, I can't find it just now. One who surrenders unto me with their heart sincerely, I'm their protector, and I will take care of them. Where's that nice quote? Here it is. It's under Being a Surrendered Soul, page 99. In Nisringa Purana, Lord Nisringadeva says, anyone who prays to me and takes shelter of me becomes my ward, and I protect him always from all sorts of calamities. Like Prahlad. How was Prahlad Maharaj considering himself? Insignificant. Less than insignificant. Bad. Insignificant and bad. No qualification. Disqualification. And he cited his disqualifications. But then, because he was being asked, despite his disqualifications, he was ready to offer the service asked by him, by the demigods, to offer prayers to the Lord, appreciating that because the Lord is merciful, He'll accept. It's His nature. Even what I have to offer is insignificant. He's merciful, and He'll accept it. And that's our hope. That's spiritual reality. It's not something, a material kind of humble. It's a reality kind of humble. There's a material kind of, supposing people don't have a spiritual conception, then there is a material idea of being humble. You bend over forward. There was one, nice reference like this. One of these generic stories that a disciple comes before a spiritual master and they say, oh, it's very difficult, this problem, that problem, the other problem. I'm feeling so difficult. What should I do, Guru Maharaj? And the spiritual master said, this is a very profound question, let's consider it. Come back tomorrow. So he came back the next day. The spiritual master was leaned over like that, looking down. And the disciple said, "What's wrong, Guru Maharaj?" And he just stayed down like this. And then eventually he sat up and said, "It works." You think lowly of yourself and you'll feel like that. That's the material conception. The spiritual conception is, as spirit soul, we're part of the Supreme Soul. That part is 1/10,000th the size of the tip of a hair. How significant is that? Tiny, insignificant. But from a spiritual perspective, being a part and parcel of the Supreme Lord, that's fantastic. From a material perspective, being a servant, oh, that's not good. I've literally had people say like that to me, public, public. You shouldn't, you're a nice young man, you shouldn't take this position. People will take advantage of you. Stand up and, assert yourself. People will take advantage of you. But it's being a servant of the personality of Godhead is glorious. And that's what this verse from chapter 10 is saying, expecting the mercy of the Lord from a spiritual perspective. Bhajate mam ananya bhak. The verse is saying that this is Lord Brahma. He's the one that's speaking this verse, chapter 14 of, chapter 14, text number 8. After he's stolen the calves and the cowherd boys, and he has this whole experience of not just seeing the calves and the cowherd boys in the cave and simultaneously manifest by Krishna, where they're having lunch. So Krishna, that's superlative. Krishna manifested identical forms of the calves and the cowherd boys. That was a good trick. But it wasn't just identical forms of the calves and the cowherd boys. Then those calves and cowherd boys became transformed into forms of Narayan. And those forms of Narayan, each one of them, forms of Narayan, surrounded by the personified Vedas. And the great demigods and the Apsaras and Kinnaras and offering prayers and glorification of the Supreme Lord, singing His praises in great enthusiastic voices. And then all of a sudden, they all disappeared again. And all he could see was the personality of Godhead, this little boy, with his left hand extended with a lump of yogurt and food in his hand, looking with unblinking eyes at Lord Brahma, smiling, saying nothing. Lord Brahma had one of those uh-oh experiences. Uh-oh. I made a big mistake. And he realized that there would be a reaction for his big mistake. And this verse is saying, let that reaction come. Because when we do something that's wrong, or sinful or whatever, not to be done. Sometimes those things happen. Even, without proper contemplation, even sometimes we foolishly allow ourselves to do something foolish. And however, the preamble is, when something wrong is done, there's going to be a reaction. And now what are you going to do? What he decided to do was not to try to neutralize the reaction. To try to, make it look like it wasn't a wrongdoing, or appeal to Krishna, please reduce the reaction. Give me a plea bargain. Make a plea. I did something wrong, but I, Now I understand it was wrong, so please make the sentence a little less. He didn't try to fool around with the reaction that was coming. Rather, he accepted fully the reaction. I'm due to receive a reaction, let it come. But one thing, he states, is that my mind did not budge one inch, one fraction of an inch, one iota from the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. For by maintaining that position of fixing my mind on the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, I know He's merciful. And by just maintaining fixed position like that, I will inherit the property of my father. Who's the father of Lord Brahma? Pancha. Who's the father of Lord Brahma? Lord Brahma. Father of Lord Brahma. Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, right. Struck his heart with fear and panic. Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, right? Yeah. So, the property of his father, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, that's the kingdom of God. I will inherit the kingdom of God. I'll become liberated. I'll become a resident in the spiritual world. If I just do one thing, keep my mind fixed upon the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. Prabhupada explains this, that in the law within India today, as within the law of Manu, as Lord Brahma understood it, the son becomes the inheritor of the property of the father. Now, that's when the father becomes deceased. In the case of Lord Vishnu, he doesn't become deceased. We may become deceased. We will become deceased, but he doesn't. But if I just fix my mind upon the personality of Godhead, I become the inheritor of my father's property. I'll attain the Vaikuntha realm. I'll go back to Godhead. Here come the reactions. Back that way, there are some things that I've done that are good, bad, and mixed. Coming at me is the reaction, those good, bad, and mixed. I just keep my mind fixed upon the personality of Godhead, not making it my business to make the nice ones nicer and the difficult ones less difficult. Just keep my mind fixed on let the reactions come, whatever they may be. Specifically, this is the reactions to my past misdeeds. Let them come. I'm not going to make it my business to try to manipulate them or manage them. I'm going to keep my mind fixed upon the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, continuing to stay in this mood of servitorship and expecting the Lord's mercy is the message of Lord Brahma. I think there's a reason why Braja Vihari asked me to spend a lot of time on that one verse, because that's at the heart of our devotional practice. This is speaking of the previous two chapters, devotional practice, and the next chapters, devotional practice of devotion. Specifically, this chapter, the techniques of hearing and chanting and remembering. Practicing devotional service. While we're practicing devotional service, there's something that's at the heart of it all. We're not qualified. But there's a supremely merciful master. And if I just take up these activities, reposing faith and trust and confidence in the loving nature of the personality of Godhead, He'll be merciful. He's merciful. Just like the sun is shining. The sun shines. The sun shines equally everywhere. The rain falls equally everywhere. But sometimes we're hiding under a rock and we don't see the sunshine. We're under something and we don't receive the benefit of the rain. But the rain falls equally everywhere. So the mercy of the personality of Godhead is available to anyone, everyone. Qualified, unqualified, whatever is back there. We face the direction of the sun, and the light of the sun comes. So that's the spirit of the practices of devotional service. It's, you can say, at the heart of all of these other, as the chapter heading is, techniques. Prabhupada writes in Nectar Devotion that in the practice of devotional service, it's not the activities in themselves that cause elevation, it's the consciousness behind the activities. Let's say, for example, deity worship. Is there something implied in, spiritually implied, in ringing a bell or waving a stick of incense in so many circles and so many circles? And is it implicitly spiritually elevating? The answer is no. When was it? It was just yesterday morning. Was it yesterday morning? Yes, yesterday morning. Is the Bhai here? Yesterday morning here in the temple, so I gave a morning Bhagavatam class. I was reading from Chaitanya Charitamrita. And at the end, a Bhai was making some question about how to deal with atheists, because he was speaking about down in the, whatever you call it, the mall. There was an assembly of people that were, he gave it a euphemistic name, but it was atheists of, you know, the area. An assembly of, you know, reason, something like that. Call for reason. And their message was, there's no God. What's the reason behind God? Coincidentally, the same day, I received a question from the question and answer thing that started many, many years ago here at Washington, D.C., and is continuing just under a different banner. But somebody's been listening to some scientist atheist over here, and then this other guy over here, a comedian guy, and he just makes fun of religion. And he's, and the individual is saying, you know, what they're saying makes sense. It makes sense if you don't understand what the essence of it is. You know, somebody that has faith in ringing a bell and waving a stick of incense. Or, so I went to the website of that person. That person is showing what different people do. The Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, and, you know, what different people do of different religious practices. And his whole comedian life, his career is made up of making fun of the activities, the essence behind those activities he's not addressing. And somebody that doesn't know the essence behind those activities looks at what the comedian is saying and say, you know, I think it makes some sense, and how do I respond to that? You follow the point? So Nectar Devotion is giving us techniques. So this particular little section, expecting the Lord's mercy, is at the essence. It's not the activity itself. Except there are activities like chanting the holy name. They're directly devotional, even if you don't know what it is. The form of it is not the essence. The essence is the essence. And just chant Krishna's name, even you don't know what it is. Even you don't intend to chant Krishna's name, like a jamil. There is potency there. But there's other activities where what is done is not the essence, but the consciousness behind it is the essence. And there's this expectation of Krishna's mercy that's at the essence. I'm very... Prabhupada, I share this. Prabhupada once explained, Krishna consciousness is very simple. Three things. God is very great. I am very small. Therefore, I should serve Him. That is Krishna consciousness. End of class. So to understand how God is great, and factually how tiny we are, just like the Chaitanya Charitamrita section. To understand the greatness of Krishna, let's take a look at the material world, the one-quarter portion compared to the three-quarter portion. The three-quarter portion we can't possibly conceive of. Let's look at the one-quarter portion. The one-quarter portion is inconceivable also. And he gives examples to show it's inconceivable. So, who can estimate the unlimited potencies of the unlimited when we're limited? Answer, you can't. If there's some revelation, you can get something. Some little sliver, a hint, a glimmer, a glimpse of an idea. More than an idea, an experience of the merciful nature of the Supreme Lord. And that glimpse of the merciful nature of the Supreme Lord, that carries one forward in devotional service. And so the rest of what I'm going to say is built around that. There's a number of nice things that are said. I'll go back to the beginning. Techniques of hearing and remembering. I'm going to cover maybe 10 different little passages with specific points connected to them. The first section is about hearing. As usual, Prabhupada makes strong emphasis, the whole of the Bhagavatam does, and so similarly in Nectar Devotion, strong emphasis on the process of hearing. Everything in spiritual life begins from hearing. Gives the example of a man that's asleep, gives the example that man has been bitten by a poisonous serpent. And the way that it's explained, when you're bitten by a snake bite, I never knew this before reading Nectar Devotion, but you don't die right away. The body becomes dysfunctional, but you're in a coma for a while. And during that comatose state, if you get a very, very expert snake charmer, or one can extract by mantra the poison of the snake bite, then the person can come out of the coma and live. And if you don't, they're gone. So there's that period of time after the snake bite. So the mantra, that the spiritual sound vibration that one can hear, takes us out of the comatose-like state, nearly dead-like state, spiritually dead-like state of forgetfulness of our relationship with Krishna. So hearing is the most important. It's the beginning, but it's also the ongoing middle and end. Hearing. Transcendental sound vibration to fix our consciousness. Awaken and fix our consciousness upon the Supreme. There's a there's a number of descriptions that describe the benefit from hearing comes remembering. From hearing and chanting comes remembering. It's not the rote memorization of, you know, 2 plus 2 is 4, and 4 plus 4 is 8, and 8 plus 8 is 16, and 16 plus 16 is 32, and 32 plus 32 is 6. It's not just a mechanical something out there, and you bring it in here, and then you can just recite it. Like listening to children reciting the alphabet. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and so on. Not like that. Not some, that kind of recitation, rote recitation remembrance. Remembrance of something that's already there. Spiritual awareness, spiritual awakeness that's dormant and can be made awakened. And once it's awakened, then there's remembrance. Remembrance of our true spiritual identity, progressively the Supreme and our relationship with the Supreme and our particular eternal situation in relationship with the Supreme. It's just this morning, hearing Prabhupada describe, we actually have spiritual form, but it's dormant. And like we have this covering, this body, gross and subtle. And the gross and subtle is covering that which we really are. By the process of hearing, that which we really are becomes activated. And the gross and subtle coverings become spiritualized, and they can act in a spiritual way because the spirit soul within becomes animated and activated on the spiritual plane. And that's the benefit of this process of hearing. And from it simultaneously so many other things. Reactions to our past sins are eradicated, and so many nice things from scriptural quotes. So remembrance of our identity and our relationship with Krishna grow from the process of hearing. And under meditation, which is very similar to hearing, Prabhupada writes, to meditate means to engage the mind in thinking of the form of the Lord, the qualities of the Lord, the activities of the Lord, and the service of the Lord. Meditation doesn't mean anything impersonal or void. According to Vedic literature, meditation means meditation on Vishnu. Gives a quote from the Sringa Purana. There's a statement about meditation on the form of the Lord. It is said there, meditation, focusing on the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, has been accepted as transcendental and beyond the experience of material pain and pleasure. That would be nice, huh? Hari Sori told me a couple of Prabhupada stories. I was sitting with him having lunch in Mayapur. I said, Hari Sori, I heard you've had the health problem. Are you doing better? He said, well, it's getting a little better. It's still some difficulty. And because he's Hari Sori, he immediately started thinking of Prabhupada and then described Prabhupada dealing with physical pain. He said, one time I was with Srila Prabhupada and he had an abscess tooth. Abscess means big infection, your whole cheek puffs out, and you know what it's like when you get a toothache. You can't think of anything else but the toothache, it aches. So this wasn't just a toothache, this was an abscess. So the devotees were trying to persuade Prabhupada to go to a dentist. And Prabhupada just declined, no, don't need a dentist. Just give me some cloves. So he just put cloves in his mouth and it made the abscess more numb. And he just went on. And then some days later, Prabhupada was taking prasadam. He reached in his mouth and pulled out the tooth and handed the tooth to Hari Sori and said, here, you can keep this. And continued with his prasadam. He wasn't unaware, but he was transcendental because his consciousness was somewhere else. When your consciousness is somewhere else, this something that's on this physical plane doesn't affect you in the same way. Proportionate to your Krishna consciousness, the material circumstances are not affecting you in the same way, including even pleasure and pain. Then another example that he told me, after that example of the tooth, was also something that I didn't know, that Prabhupada had one kidney that didn't work at all and one kidney that worked half. And those of you that have some medical knowledge know what that means. The body doesn't eliminate toxins and poisons. So his body was regularly toxic and poisonous, and you know, it weakens the body. and it's painful. So it was for that reason that Prabhupada regularly had massage to help relieve the body by other means of toxins within the body and just relieve the aches and pains of his body. But he even given his age and given the weakness of the internal organs of his body, it didn't slow him down. He was, in the fast lane. He was keeping a schedule that it took three of his strong young American disciples to keep up with him, just to supply things that he required. Slept very, very little, and he told me there were two times. One was in Bombay in the middle of the night, 1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning. Prabhupada rang the bell on his desk, and Prabhupada was sitting there with the chatter over his head, and his whole body was shivering. And he said, "I'm in too much pain, I can't translate." Twice that happened. And otherwise, he just transcended the pain because his consciousness was so fixed on Krishna. We shouldn't imitate, but we can understand by example. We can understand from our own experience also. If we're very much absorbed in something, the inconvenience of fatigue or hunger or some pain is just not affecting us. You shouldn't imitate, but the principle can be understood. There's a statement in Padma Purana about remembering the activities of the Lord. A person who is always engaged in meditation on the sweet pastimes and wonderful activities of the Lord surely becomes freed from all material contamination. And then he finishes the chapter telling this wonderful Brahma Vaivarta Purana story of one Brahmin from South India who was quite poor, but very, very pure. And those aren't contradictory. One can be poor and pure. One can be wealthy and pure. One can be poor and pure. This one was the second category. And he was attending a discourse where he heard that one can worship the Supreme Lord in meditation. So because he was very poor and he wanted to serve the Lord opulently, he took the message literally and went to the bank of the Godavari and took his bath and sat there and meditated on very opulent worship. And it became a regular practice. He would do this every day. He'd spend hours meditating on opulently worshiping his deity because he was poor and also a little infirm. He didn't have the capacity. You know the story. He was one day in those meditations, he was making sweet rice and he was testing to see if it was cool enough to offer to the deity. And he stuck his thumb in the pot and burned his thumb in the pot. And then his meditation broke and he looked at his thumb. His thumb was burned. So he could understand that meditation and worship was the same. Although he wasn't physically able, the meditation process, because of his sincere effort, we shouldn't do the same. Sit in our room and meditate on worshiping our deity and let the deity stand on the altar. We worship the deity. Practical sense activity connecting with the object, the Supreme Lord. So, that's a quick summary of chapter 10, techniques of hearing and remembering. Some very nice points are made in chapter 11. Aspects of transcendental service, starting with servitorship. So, in the beginning, Prabhupada makes a distinction between devotional service and pure devotional service. And he says it three times. in essence, pure devotional service is where there's no motivation. Just like Rupa Goswami's definition, it goes way back in the very beginning part. It's presented in the introduction to Nectar Devotion, but it's chapter 1 of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Anyabhilashita Shunyam Jnana Karma Janavatam. So here is he's saying it again in the following way. In the Skanda Purana, it is said that those who are attached to ritualistic activities, the four orders of social life, and the four orders of spiritual life, are considered devotees. But when devotees are actually engaged in offering service to the Lord directly, these must be Bhagavatas, or pure devotees. And he says it again. Those who are engaged in fruitive activities or prescribed duties according to the four orders of social and spiritual life are not actually pure devotees. But still, because they are offering the result to the Lord, they are accepted as devotees. When one has no such desire, but acts spontaneously out of love of God, such a person must be accepted as a pure devotee. Three times. Devotees and devotees. Or devotees and pure devotees. So, the lower category, or the, you know, the attached to fruitive activities mentioned in the Vedas, generally there's a mix. I want something. And so to get that something, I do this fruitive activity and I offer the result to the Supreme Lord. That's mixed. Such a person, one way to consider, such a person is a devotee. Because they want to offer the fruits unto the Lord. Another way of saying the same thing is that's not devotional service, that's karma yoga. Where one offers the fruits unto the Supreme Lord. I'm attached. But I don't like the entanglement that comes with the attachment. So I offer the result to the Supreme Lord. Make my hands clean. In one sense, that's karma yoga. In a broader sense, it's devotional service. Because there's the connection with the Supreme Lord. The Lord should be the enjoyer of this activity. The verse from Bhagavad Gita, Yad Kuroshi, Yad Asnasi, Yad Shahosi, Dadasi, Yad Yad Tapasyasi Kauntaya, Tat Kurashra Madarpanam. That verse is karma yoga. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer in charity, give away, austerity, etc. Do that as an offering to the Supreme. That's karma yoga. And then the distinction is, with pure devotional service, there's no such motivation, there's no such attachment to this activity, that activity, and the benefit that I get from it. It's a spontaneous offering of love to the Supreme. Such a person must be accepted as a pure devotee. And then he elaborates. The conditioned souls who have come into contact with the material world are more or less desirous of lording it over material nature. The system of Varnashram and the prescribed duties under this system are so designed that the conditioned soul may enjoy in the material world according to his desire for sense gratification and at the same time gradually be elevated to spiritual understanding. Under these prescribed duties of Varnashram, there are many activities which belong to devotional service in Krishna consciousness. Then he goes back. You know, so there's the gradual and there's the direct. And the more that proportionately, the more that one can be detached from the expectation for fulfilling some desire in exchange for the devotional service, or along with the devotional service, proportionate instead to the becoming attached to the pleasure of the Supreme Lord, that becomes, that's the measure of purity. He writes, I'm reading at the top of page 96. Srila Rupa Goswami describes one who is fit for becoming engaged in devotional service. He says that persons who are neophytes and who have developed a little love of Godhead are not interested in the activities of sense gratification in proportion to their devotion. Directly proportionate, or inversely proportionate. Sense gratification over here, devotional service over here. Like that. But if there is still some attraction for sense gratifying activities, then the result of such activities should be offered to Krishna. It's called dovetail. That's a phrase that Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur uses in Sri Brahma Samhita, and Prabhupada similarly used dovetail. I learned something from a devotee who is a carpenter. There's a carpentry system called dovetail. Maybe it's coincidence, maybe it's just Bhaktisiddhanta's language, it's a dictionary definition. Dovetail is when you have a piece of wood and a piece of wood, and you want to join the pieces of wood, and you can make them into one piece of wood. And it's something about making a notch and then a little opening and then a notch and an opening, and you fit them together, and it's join them together by this term. It's called dovetail. And it's said that that makes an even stronger piece of wood than just a piece of wood. In any case, this together with that, this fits very nicely. It's acceptable for Krishna, and I like such and such. I like music. I like dance. I like drama. I like horticulture. I like making nice clothing. I like something. I like. Oh, and that can be done in Krishna service. Great. Dovetail. With the I like part, there's what's in it for me. Oh, by the way, there's something in it for Krishna too, so I can put the two together. So proportionate to the idea of sense gratification, devotion is weakened. Proportionate to the detachment from sense gratification, devotion is strengthened. To the point where I can do anything for Krishna. It doesn't matter whether I like or don't like. That's a nice platform, but you know, when we're faced with those options of something I don't like and do it for Krishna. But when there's genuine devotion, it doesn't matter. Later on, when it's describing rasa, later chapters, the example, because this is servitorship, the example of the rasa of servitorship is Pradyumna, Krishna's son. Krishna and Rukmini had a son named Pradyumna. And he's, by the way, one of the Chaturvyuha. Vasudev Sankarshan, Pradyumna and Aniruddha. So Pradyumna, as the son of Krishna, had the rasa of servitorship. And if Krishna wanted something, and Pradyumna didn't want that something, he would do that something because Krishna wanted that something. And the other way around. If Krishna didn't want something and he wanted something, he would forgo that something because Krishna didn't want that something. Because of the strength of rasa, of servitorship, where you accept the will of the beloved as your will, out of love. So your wants just fade. And what Krishna wants, that's servitorship. And he's the master. It doesn't matter. Literally, it doesn't matter what my wants are. It's what Krishna's wants are. That's what matters. That's servitorship. And then this quote from Naradiya Purana, where servitorship is transcendental. It's said there that a person who is constantly engaged in service by his body, mind, and words, or even a person who is not particularly practically engaged, but is simply desiring to be so, is considered liberated. There's a place in Bhagavad Gita where Prabhupada states something very similar. He says, one of the best ways to fix the mind, my dear devotees, next time you're finding some difficulty fixing your mind, it's wandering and troubling you, and remember this one. It's Bhagavad Gita. One of the best ways to fix the mind is to think of ways to expand bhakti, the execution of devotional service in this world. Even if you cannot do so, contemplating how to do so. Don't just spin out and, you know, pipe dream, but consider practical ways to bring the opportunity of contact with bhakti into the lives of other people. Even one other person, or a number of persons, or the world of persons. Consider the ways and means for doing that, and it's a great way to fix the mind. Then you do some of them according to your capacity. Next comes, after servitorship, comes friendship. Dasya and Sakya. Serving Krishna in friendship. Interestingly, Prabhupada refers to Draupadi. Because Draupadi, the comment is that Bhishma Dev, the grandfather of the Pandavas, considered the difficulties that the Pandavas endured and Draupadi endured. Draupadi, being practically the equivalent of the goddess of fortune, was undergoing so many difficulties. It was unbearable for Bhishma Dev to consider what difficulties they had undergone. He speaks like that to Yudhisthira in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the 9th chapter of the 1st canto. But Draupadi considered though their tribulations were not ordinary, Draupadi was not discouraged. She knew that because Krishna was their friend, ultimately they would be saved. I mean, certainly got to circumstances where it didn't look like it. Draupadi was not discouraged. She knew that because Krishna was their friend, ultimately they would be saved. Now remember the highlight, the banner of this today's class is this expecting the Lord's mercy. So, you know, we from our position being insignificant specks, still we can expect the Lord's mercy. And Draupadi, if we had to endure what Draupadi had to endure, according to Grandfather Bhishma, we wouldn't survive. We wouldn't survive. Prabhupada spoke like that to us, his disciples, about what he endured when he came to New York without a place to stay, without any way to have something, surety of something to eat each day, without even having a place to take a bath, a paka Vaishnav, a pure devotee, not even knowing where he would take his bath. Dr. Mishra gave him a place to stay in an office that had no bathroom, no water, no shower, nothing. Could in the middle of the winter in New York City, in a place that's not at all friendly. Could we do that? Prabhupada made it very clear, you wouldn't be able to do it. But nonetheless, Prabhupada inspired or instilled confidence in his disciples to do Mission Impossibles over and over again. Let me just spin out a little bit and tell you one story that I heard from Guru Gauranga Prabhu, Prabhupada's disciple. He was a graduate from Harvard Law School in a fraction of the number of years it normally takes, because he was brilliant. I mean, brilliant, super scholar. Because he was so scholarly, when he graduated in a short number of years compared to what everybody else takes, he was the top of his class. He got an honors opportunity to study at the Sorbonne. So within one summer, he learned to speak French because he had that capacity. They went to France. And he was walking around the streets of France. And he saw one devotee, and if you knew the person, I would say his name if you might know the person. He's a Vata person. His feet don't touch the ground. He's always, floating around somewhere in Vata land. Very cerebral and, not grounded person. And he was standing on a street corner. He was French-Canadian, speaking to French people. Those of you who don't know French people, they're very confrontational and aggressive. There were three of them surrounding one little skinny brahmachari, harassing him in French. And he was just very calmly responding to their, wearing a dhoti, responding to their harassments. And Guru Granga had never met devotees before, and he just marveled at what he saw. Here's this little skinny guy with three Frenchmen harassing him. And he's as calm as a cucumber. Real cool. So finally they left and he went over and he was curious, who are you and what's up? He said, I'm a Hare Krishna devotee and, why don't you come with me and come back to our restaurant? Oh, restaurant. Okay, I've become vegetarian, so go to your vegetarian restaurant. Then he found out that Prabhupada was going to be coming to town in something like a week. So here he is, a Sorbonne student, and hears about Prabhupada. He never heard of Prabhupada before. He meets the devotees, and they're all like, Prabhupada ki jai, and he doesn't know who Prabhupada is at all. So he stayed around, and he met Prabhupada, and within something like from the time that he met this particular devotee to the time that Prabhupada, he had a personal conversation with Prabhupada, it was maybe 2 weeks, if my memory serves me right. And Prabhupada suggested, oh, you're very well educated. You can pick up on languages very quickly. Why don't you go to either Austria or Switzerland? Austria. And why don't you try to start a Hare Krishna center in Austria? 2 weeks. 2 weeks. Here's this brilliant scholar. 2 weeks. And so he went. And I was in tears hearing this description. Guru Gauranga didn't have any money. It was like Prabhupada going to the West. He didn't have any money, didn't have any place to stay. So where did he stay? He stayed in the boiler rooms of big apartment buildings because there it was warm. He didn't say where he bathed. Somewhere he bathed. He just, through the winter in Austria, in Vienna, he started a Hare Krishna center from nothing after 2 weeks of being with Prabhupada. Wow. Something happened. Prabhupada was very powerful. And Guru Granga was very eager to receive what Prabhupada had to give. And the combination made an explosion. And he spread Krishna consciousness there, and later he went to Zurich and became the temple president in Zurich. And what became one of the largest book distribution programs in the whole world out of the city of Zurich. He had material qualification, but that wasn't what did it. It was this incredible dedication and devotion to Prabhupada. So, the impossible becomes possible when there is the sense of shelter and being protected by the personality of Godhead and his dear representatives. So like Draupadi, the tribulations weren't ordinary, but she wasn't discouraged. She knew that Krishna was their friend and ultimately they would be saved. Having that sense of safety and security and well-being, because Krishna is merciful. Dayabak. He's merciful. He'll whatever it is that we require, Krishna will supply. What's that verse from Bhagavad Gita? Whatever it is that one requires, whatever it is Krishna will supply, whatever it is that one has, Krishna will preserve. Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam. No. Ananyas chintayantamam ye jana paryupasate. Yoga kshema vahamyam. That's the verse. Yoga kshema vahamyam. Krishna preserves what one has and carries what one lacks. And that's the confidence. Self-confidence is confidence in Krishna. Real self-confidence is not, you know, no fear. That's bluff. Real self-confidence is confidence in Krishna. Are we doing all right? Okay. Just continuing on. Prabhupada is defining what is the position. There was devotee, then pure devotee, beginning of the chapter. Now he's using this language, first class devotee, which is very similar to pure devotee. My dear king, this is next paragraph down, a person who never deviates, even for a moment, from engagement in service at the lotus feet of the Supreme Person, engagement which is sought even by great demigods like Indra, with firm conviction that there is nothing more desirable or worshipable than this. It's called the first class devotee. So it's full shelter. Full shelter. No other shelter but the personality of Godhead. So there's the neophyte. He has a little glimpse, some sense of attraction for Krishna, some sense of attraction for service on the spiritual platform, not matured, not so well developed, but that's the candidate for devotional service. And then progressively exercising the regulations of sadhana bhakti becomes matured. And in that mature stage, fixed in devotional service. Such a person is guaranteed of going back to Godhead, is what is being described here. Then a few more pages. Surrendering everything to the Lord. Atmanivedana. That's one of the nine processes. Shravanam, hearing. Kirtanam, chanting. Smaranam, remembrance. Then Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam. He skipped some, but now this is Atmanivedanam. This self-surrender is called Atmanivedana. According to different authorities, self is differently defined. Self is sometimes considered to refer to the spirit self or soul. And self sometimes is considered to refer to the mind or to the body. Full self-surrender, therefore, means not only surrendering oneself as spirit soul, but surrendering one's mind and body to the service of the Lord. Jamunacharya is quoted here as saying, whether I'm in the body of a human being or a demigod or whatever is inconsequential, because the body is temporary, supplied by material nature. What's consequential is the dedication to the service of the Supreme Lord. This principle of Atmanivedana. And from whatever my position, let me remain surrendered unto you. Very similar to the Lord Brahma's verse that we spoke about. If there's some reaction coming my way, so be it. Something like the discussion we had yesterday about King Chitraketu, when he heard that he was going to be cursed by Parvati to become a demon, Let it come. If I've made offense to Mother Parvati, even if I haven't, but if she thinks that I have, so be it. I can serve from that position. I can serve from any position. Let me not be deprived of devotional service, whatever the situation may arise, moving down the path of life. Let me somehow become fixed in the position of devotional service to the personality of Godhead. Then in Hari Bhakti Viveka, there is a statement how one can offer his body in self-surrender. The devotee says, quote, "My dear Lord, as a souled animal has no need to think about his maintenance and sustenance, so, because I have given up my body and soul unto you, I am no longer concerned with my maintenance and sustenance." What does that mean? Just surrender to Krishna. You don't have to go to work anymore. That's not what it means. Some heads came up. Hey, no more work. Just surrender to Krishna. But you do that as a service to Krishna. And Krishna is my maintainer. Not my effort is my maintainer. And then over here I worship Krishna. That's secular. I worship Krishna and I do something for my material situation. That's secularism. And that's not Krishna consciousness. We don't have this bifurcated. Sometimes people say, how do I balance between spiritual and my duties of life? The answer is, don't see a distinction between the two. It's all part of devotional service. Huh? What does that have to do with devotional service? You do that for Krishna. And that's what's being described in this section. I'll read some more of it. In other words, one should not bother. Here we go. Yeah. One should not bother about his personal or family maintenance or sustenance. What does that mean? Quit your job? No. If one is actually surrendered in body and soul, he should always remember that his only concern is to be engaged in the service of the Lord. Here's another, going over to the other page, page 99, in the Narada Pancharata, same idea being developed. There is a statement of how one can act in all spheres of life for the satisfaction of the Lord. It is said that a person who is actually in devotional service must be engaged in all kinds of activities, those prescribed in the revealed scriptures, and also those which are accepted for livelihood. In other words, not only should a devotee engage himself in prescribed duties of devotional service which are mentioned in the revealed scriptures, but he should also perform the duties of his practical life in Krishna consciousness. You dedicate everything in Krishna consciousness, in Krishna service. Now, in this case, he gives a very clear example of karma yoga. A rich person, big industrialist, he has wealth, build a temple for Krishna. So we're not big industrialists. We have something. With our something, we serve Krishna. Here's one of Krishna's temples, and contribute to the deity worship and the book distribution and the festivals and the functions and the programs and do my little part. But that's, if it just stays on that platform that it is karma yoga, let my everything, the more complete the platform of devotional service or the consciousness of bhakti becomes strong. The interest in these material affairs diminishes. In fact, they're acting as material affairs in the sense that they're binding and we don't see Krishna there. That disappears. They're not binding and we see Krishna there. Krishna's giving me an opportunity to serve him in so many, many different ways. And as our Krishna, through the process of hearing, our consciousness awakens, everything becomes part of Krishna's territory. In the same class that I was listening to this morning, when Prabhupada was explaining that we have a spiritual form, swarup, sva Rup means our spiritual form. We have a spiritual form. It's covered. Like, you know, a shirt is covering the body and pants are covering our legs or hat is covering our head. But beneath that, there's the body. So beneath the body, there's this spiritual form. And he was explaining, someone was asking, this was in London, someone was asking, how do we go to the spiritual sky? And his answer was, we're in the spiritual sky. There's a cloud that's covering the spiritual sky. But we're in the spiritual sky now. We're just seeing the covering. We're not seeing the spiritual sky. We're not seeing Krishna. But Krishna is present everywhere. We're already here. Krishna consciousness means to remove the deluding potency so we see it separate from Krishna by the deluding potency and see it in relation to Krishna. And while the manifestation may be temporary, we can be in Vaikuntha. Now. Right now. And then he said, this temple is not in London. This temple is in Vaikuntha. And everyone went, oh. He said, you tell the Londoners this is not in London, it's in Vaikuntha. And they'll go, oh. But this is Vaikuntha. Why? Because everyone is engaged in service to Krishna, remembering Krishna, serving Krishna. That's Vaikuntha. The energy may be temporary, and in Vaikuntha realm, the energy is not temporary, it's eternal. But the consciousness is Vaikuntha consciousness. And through Vaikuntha consciousness, or Krishna consciousness, you create the spiritual atmosphere. You enter into the internal potency. That's the process of devotional service that's being described. How to spiritualize our material lives. Not just through the activities of sadhana bhakti, but through the activities of everything else that we do. That's what's being stated directly right here in this chapter. Just one more point. Being a surrendered soul. First, a dedication to everything, but the mood of surrender is an essential element of all activities of devotional service. In the Hari Bhakti Vilas, there's the following statement about self-surrender. My dear Lord, a person who has surrendered himself unto you, who is in firm conviction that he is yours, and who actually acts in that way by his body, mind, and words, can actually relish transcendental bliss. And here's this Nrisimha Purana. Lord Nrisimhadeva says, anyone who prays unto me and takes shelter from me becomes my ward, and I protect him always from all sorts of calamities. Now, all sorts of calamities doesn't mean you don't get old, you never get sick, and you're never going to die. That's not what it means. Because those types of calamities are built into the material world. But the greatest calamity is forgetfulness of Krishna and seeing all things separate from Krishna. That's very painful. That's the greatest calamity. Losing our connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Lord Nrisimhadeva may in fact, as he did with Prahlad, protect him from being put to death by Hiranyakashipu and his accomplices. But that may happen, that may not happen. We don't go walking across the highway and rush hour traffic and think Krishna will protect me because I'm his devotee and take care. We don't do foolish things. But if we're in the course of engaging in service to Krishna, we're expecting Krishna's protection. Here, Lord Srinidhi's protection. The greatest calamity is to forget Krishna. The greatest wonderful thing is to remember Krishna at every moment and then at the time of death. Ante Narayana Smriti. So, I'll end just with a refresh on this one verse that Raja Bihari suggested that I just focus upon. That verse, you'll find it in Bhagavad Gita as well. in one purport, tatte nukampam susamikshamano. It's a nice phrase to remember. And just hearing the phrase invokes remembrance of the message of Lord Brahma. Just have full trust or confidence in Krishna's kindness, his merciful nature, such that whatever reactants may be coming that due to me, I deserve, let them come. Let me not get distracted with the complexities of eternal life and the reactants of my past deeds. I accept them. The main thing is, where should my mind go? My mind should go to the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead. That means to stay fixed in the mood of his service. Fixed in a mood of humble service. Serving the personality of Godhead in all circumstances. Those things will pass. The good and the bad of the mix will pass. Time will move everything. Let me use whatever time I have, this valuable human form of life, whatever time I have fixed in trying to, in the most optimum way, serve the personality of Godhead favorably. And everything will be all right. Ultimately, the spiritual entrance into the spiritual realm will be the outcome. And I want to be there. I don't want to be just forever struggling with the material energy. Daivahiyesha gudamayi mama maya duratyaya ma mevi papadyante maya mitam durantite. I want that. I want to go to Krishna. I want to be with Krishna. Let me keep my mind fixed on Krishna. And that will be my destination, because even I'm unqualified, he's very merciful. So that's the theme of these two chapters. Any discussion? Have until 12:15 for some questions. Is that right? Comments or questions? Anyone?
Maharaj, thank you very much for the class. There was one point you mentioned, that something beyond material pain and material pleasures. And you gave the example of Prabhupada while talking about the material pain. Could you please explain more on what is beyond material pleasures? What does this mean?
Spiritual pleasure. That one of the quotes specifically described, one who stays fixed in the mood of serving the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, experiences unending transcendental bliss, or anandam buddhivardhanam. Ananda ambuddhi vardhanam. Just from chanting. Ananda is spiritual bliss. Ambuddhi is an ocean. And Vardhanam is expanding the ocean. So, for our purposes, the chanting of the holy name is such access to that spiritual bliss. We can experience spiritual happiness just by serving. It's so much more satisfying than anything of this world. Acquiring something, or gaining something, or conquering something, or winning something, or whatever it is. Being a success at some endeavor. Yay. That's not ananda. Devotional service is. And those who are devotees know that. Those that aren't devotees don't have any access. I was sharing this in a home once of a devotee couple. I didn't know until afterwards that there was some disparity between the husband and wife, and what's the relevance of devotional service anyways. I just made the comment that those who aren't devotees don't understand. They can't fathom what's in it for the devotee. What's the deal? because they don't have access to that spiritual happiness. But devotee does. And that's the internal potency, and it's Krishna's mercy, and access is through the medium of devotional service of some kind. And even little, small glimpse of that, which we've all had, otherwise we wouldn't continue on. And the gradual purification that comes from devotional service, that's a spiritual happiness. Purification is a spiritual happiness. It's not just relief from agonizing over the struggles of material existence. It's a positive spiritual happiness. And as one continues progressively in devotional service, vardhanam, it expands. And our entry position or activity is through chanting, regular chanting of the holy name. Okay?
Thank you very much for the beautiful class. In the beginning of the class, you talked about having an understanding that how significant we are.
Insignificant
we are.
Yeah.
Without having a feeling of low esteem.
Yes.
So can you just elaborate a little more?
I did. What I said is, it's in contrast, we don't think low of ourselves. We just recognize the spiritual reality is we're very tiny. How tiny is the tip of a hair? How tiny is divide a tip of a hair into 100 parts? Divide one of those 100 parts into 100 parts, and that's how significant we are. It's smaller than an atom. That's who we are. How significant is that? How many atoms are there? And we're smaller than that. That's one category of spiritual reality. Or another one that Prabhupada spoke about, which is you're asking for elaboration. Start with the spiritual world. And in this vastness of the spiritual sky, which is unlimited, where there's unlimited Vaikuntha planets in the vastness of the spiritual sky, one of those planets is Goloka Vrindavan. Some little portion of the sky is covered by a cloud called the Mahatattva. And the cloud of Mahatattva, portion of a plenary portion of the Supreme Lord, expands into that Mahatattva as Mahavishnu. And from Mahavishnu's body come unlimited numbers of, and so forth, universes. And within those so many universes, the smallest of those universes is this one. And in this universe, there's so many planets. And of those so many planets, one of the little small ones is the Earth planet. Those Earth planets, there's seven continents. And seven continents, there's one called North America. One of those continents, there's United States. One of those states is Virginia. And within Virginia is this little place called Potomac. And here we are, you know, in one part of Potomac. Just go out in the traffic and see how many cars are out there in the traffic. Even on a holiday weekend, it's not a rush hour traffic. There's a zillion cars out there. And here we are, thinking ourselves significant. We're insignificant. We're insignificant. But due to the covering of false ego, we're thinking the opposite. We're significant. We're trying to pump ourselves up and become more significant. Is the deluding potency. We're insignificant. But that's not, you know, in t- taken in relation to the personality of Godhead, it's not low self-esteem, it's just we're insignificant. But what's significant in that, I explained, was we're part of Krishna, who is the supreme significant. And we have a relationship with Him. And He loves us. Even we're this little insignificant speck. It's a very natural thing. The Father loves the Son. Natural thing. As we find it in this world, it's in the spiritual world. And that love for Krishna is there, and He's extending Himself to us in so many ways, and we're being this stubborn, little, obstinate brat, saying, you know, something. I'm not ready yet. I need some sign. Or something. Let me finish off, you know, a little more enjoyment business before I give it up. Or something. Very significant. And still He's very kind. And still continues to extend His mercy to us. Something else.
Thank you, Maharaj. Maharaj, in a corporate world, once you reach position, then you either have to go up the ladder or you're out. So, you did talk about the balance. You take basically treat your job as a devotion service. So, how do you manage the job part there? Every year they want to do more and so you have to work hard to come up, or you're basically out of the system.
I don't consider that so awful. Being out of the system. But aside from that, while the mindset in the world in which we live, there are very few devotionally minded individuals. Krishna describes that in Bhagavad Gita. Yes? And we just discussed it yesterday when Maharaj Pariksit says it to Shukadeva Goswami, out of many millions of living entities, there's some human beings and so on. Some amongst the human beings, some are regulated by the codes of the Vedas. Of those that are regulated by the codes of the Vedas, some understand the purpose behind the regulation of the codes of the Vedas, and some of those persons then have an understanding of the soul and the purpose of this, of all these regulations, for the soul to become liberated. Some become liberated. Out of those liberated, very few of them understand the personality of Godhead. Of those that understand the personality of Godhead, very few are pure in their devotion. And here's this Ritrasura who is pure in devotion. And how'd that happen? So, don't be surprised when, you know, the atmosphere around you is, there are not so many devotees in the workplace. So they're working for another motivation, and you're working for another motivation. You're working for Krishna. And that's the system we want to be part of. And, you know, they can operate with their rules and their motivations. And the devotee that works for Krishna, factually, the devotee that works for Krishna will be more effective, more alert, more capable, more competent than the person that's working for the carrot, the promotion, and, you know, staying within the system. Krishna will protect that devotee. Krishna will empower that devotee. It's a different channel. It's the Krishna channel instead of the material channel. And it's real. There are devotees that understand that and work that way, and they're promoted. And sometimes those persons that are promoted get squeezed so hard by the system, they say, no thanks. I'll take a step down and have more discretionary time, and you guys can, you know, get squeezed. It's okay with me. because you know, I'm not going to get to the point where I don't have time for my devotional practices. So I'll take whatever it is, scale down. Or, you know, just see you later. I'll find something where I can work for Krishna. Not be squeezed by these guys.
Thank you.
And Krishna will protect. I've seen it. It may get a little shaky at times, you know, uncertain. But it's like Draupadi. Not discouraged, not worried. I'm working for Krishna, that's it. I'll, you know, to a degree, I'm aware of the games and I'll do what I need to do. But I'm not part of the game. I'm working for Krishna. That's my program. And, you know, like it or not. But that person is the best performer, and so people don't understand what's the fuel in their tank, but they like the performance. Again and again. So that's the price one has to pay for being Krishna conscious, and that's the reward that one gets for being Krishna conscious. Krishna's protection. Okay. We have to end?
12:15. One more question.
Okay, one more question. Last question. No more last question. So we're over. Okay, one last question. Whoops. Oh, sorry.
Hare Krishna.
Go ahead. Sorry. There's an extra question after your question.
Just to follow up on that, Maharaj, so, like, in the morning when we start a work, like, I'm like a computer person, so in the morning we can think, okay, we are going to work for Krishna, but then during the day, we get, like, so absorbed just in the work, we completely forget, like, about Krishna completely, and I don't know how to keep that in mind, like, the working that we are working for Krishna, and not just for getting some work, material work done.
Well, I'll give a short answer to what can be a long answer. One part is, progressively, as you're Krishna, as you become attached to Krishna, you will naturally think of Krishna. Until that stage of attachment to Krishna awakens, then it's vacillating, on and off. So be patient, continue with the process, and attachment to Krishna will come. Next, schedule intervals of break. You know, a certain, you know, realistic, based upon what's going on in the workplace kind of thing. Every hour, 2 hours, something, something, do a little time out, and, you know, connect with Krishna, break, plug in, charge a battery, think of Krishna, take a verse out, hear something, something. Reconnect with Krishna at regular intervals, just like, you know, not the whole day, but something and something, and cumulatively over time, that will help revive your Krishna consciousness. Certainly at your lunch break, something can be done that connects. So there's morning, midday, and evening. The ultimately, at the long term, is as your Krishna consciousness revives, that continuous thought of Krishna will be there, because that which you're attached to will always be in your thought. The stage of attachment to Krishna is something we have to cultivate. And we just strive by the proper means, and that will come. Turn the power on.
Maharaj, I always feel I'm getting a lot of love from Krishna.
Good.
And no, that is what's universal. Like, I can hear, you know, giving a lot of things to me.
Fantastic.
I'm not able to revert it back, like the same, like mother gives us so much amount of love and affection, but no matter whatever I do, I'm not getting fulfilled, that I'm able to contribute the same amount to Krishna that...
I'm listening.
That they're not getting satisfied. That is what, like, how we can get satisfied by, you know, showing our love. Sometimes, you know,
okay.
I feel that I'm not loving, you know, I'm in a state that even though I do something, okay, this is not really pure affection. That is what I'm feeling.
Okay. You have to begin somewhere. There's a brilliant statement. You begin where you're at. So that's where you're at, you begin there. So there's a feeling that you just expressed. The feeling of, on the one hand, you could take the microphone away from him, he's going to say something else again. on the one hand, I'm not giving back. On the other hand, I'm not feeling satisfied. But I know that I should give back, and I want to feel satisfied. Don't say anything more, because the time is up. The next class giver is waiting out in the hall for us to finish. So we're gonna finish. You begin where you are. With feeling, you offer whatever it is that you have to offer. Just even offer that prayer to Krishna. Just offer that. I'm so hard-hearted. I'm so this and that and the other thing. I don't have sufficient gratitude. I want to have that gratitude. I want to make offering to you. You know my weakness, my condition. Please accept this prayer. Start with that. And if there is some desire, then Krishna will inspire you. He'll give you the intelligence. You offer a leaf to him with devotion. You offer something to him with devotion, because he says it in Bhagavad Gita. And you do that with devotion, with whatever little devotion you have. Although he's giving you so many things, you offer something. Make a little beginning, like, you know, physical therapy, you know. Oh, that's all I can do. Because it's so weak. You got the idea. And then just keep practicing that, and hey, next thing you know, you can do a lot more. Krishna will give you the strength. He'll give you the ability. He'll give you the intelligence. He'll inspire your heart. A little bit from that position, do something. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.